He used to have a saying which really touched me, you know, that every human being is a God carrier. This real deep commitment to a theology that affirmed that we are really image bearers. And no matter how that image gets scarred, we always carry the image of God.
Welcome to Life with God, a Renovare podcast, a place for unhurried and thoughtful conversations about interactive life with God. I'm Nathan Foster, and today we conclude our series on trusted voices from the past in a conversation with Trevor Hudson, sharing about his friend, the late South African Archbishop and 1984 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Desmond Tutu. In his obituary, the New York Times referenced Desmond Tutu as a cleric who used his pulpit and spirited oratory to help bring down apartheid in South Africa, and then became the leading advocate for peaceful reconciliation. As a leader of the South African Council of Churches, and later the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, Tutu led the church to the forefront of Black South Africans' decades-long struggle for freedom. His voice was a powerful force for nonviolence in the anti-apartheid movement, earning him a Nobel Peace Prize. In a time when leaders of substance and integrity feel non-existent, Desmond Tutu stands as a powerful model for how one's devotion to Jesus can help change the world. I felt really inspired by this interview and learning more about Desmond Tutu. Trevor's gentle presence, thoughtful responses, and enthusiasm and admiration was an absolute delight. I spoke with Trevor from his home in South Africa. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Nate. Really good to be with you and to be with those who are listening as well.
Thank you. Yes, likewise. I'm very eager to hear about an important person in your country, Desmond Tutu. Can you tell us a little about him?
Wow. First of all, simply to underline, Nate, what you've just said, a really important person in our history as a country, someone who really represented the Christian faith, I believe, with a great deal of integrity and credibility, and who I think amongst people of all backgrounds gave God a very good reputation by his life and witness and his words. So yes, certainly a very important person, and I'm really not too sure where to begin in responding to your question, but I'm going to follow your next question.
Well, maybe could you give us, just for those who aren't familiar with South African apartheid, could you give just a little overview of what was going on and his role? And yeah.
Oh, thank you, Nate. Yeah, during Desmond Tutu, South African, an Anglican, someone who during the struggle against apartheid became a very important figure in terms, first of all, his own opposition to apartheid, which he articulated very clearly on theological grounds. So he saw his own opposition to apartheid as part of his witness as a Christ follower. And obviously, someone who kind of rose to, don't like using this phrase, but let me use it, rose to fame, as it were, throughout the world because of the role he played in the struggle against apartheid. And then when we did become a democratic country, he somehow was able to retain a prophetic distance from those who just had come into power. So there was a sense in which that while he took a very powerful stance against apartheid, he somehow never got locked into one political party. In the very best sense of the word, he was a statesman, and so was able to have a critical distance from all political parties, both in terms of the struggle against apartheid and also in post-apartheid society as well. He also became the Archbishop of the Anglican Church in Southern Africa, so also played, you know, many, many roles within the Christian community, not only in South Africa, but really, really throughout the world.
I would assume there was people who wanted him to be aligned with a party and pressure to do such. What do you think that took for him?
You know, I think it just simply underlined for me, certainly, and I think for many people, his own integrity in terms of his primary commitment to Christ. And I think it was because of that, I think he, and I don't want to assume too much, but I think that he really felt very deeply that if he over-aligned himself, particularly in the post-democratic South Africa, with the ruling party, I think he had a deep sense that he would lose much of his integrity and credibility as a person of faith. And in fact, near the end of his life, he spoke out very, very strongly against the ruling party, many of whom, as it were his, were people that he worked with in the struggle against apartheid. So, you know, I think that took enormous, enormous courage. And he was obviously a great friend of Nelson Mandela. And there was a sense in which the two of them, especially when we transitioned into a democratic country, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu were two very prominent figures in that transitional moment, both in terms of their relationship with each other, but both in terms of the leadership they gave to the country. And we miss both very deeply at the moment. And there seems to be, you know, a kind of vacuum at the level of moral leadership within our context right now.
What did you learn personally from him? How did he influence your life?
Well, I think the backstory to that would be, I think, my own unfolding personal contact with him. My very first contact, it was in 1978. I was a young pastor in a little kind of town just outside Johannesburg called Boksburg. And now I think of how cheeky this was, but I just remember asking him whether he would come and do some Bible studies for us. And I will never forget, you know, for four Wednesday nights, it was in winter, he traveled to be with about 30 of us. And he took us through Genesis chapter 1 and 2. And I still have my handwritten notes, you know, of those particular Bible studies. So that was the first personal bit of interaction. And then perhaps a little bit more significantly, I went to go work in Johannesburg in 1979, 1980, 1981, and he worked just around the corner. At that stage, I was working very, very much with young people in terms of setting up and creating events where particularly young white and black people could meet together. It was the apartheid era, so that was not something that often happened. And Desmond was often one of our speakers, you know, at these gatherings. So I think just the generosity and the willingness to give time to be with young folk, even as he was, I think at that stage, beginning to, as it were, you know, take on more and more wider responsibilities of leadership. Nonetheless, there was always this local commitment of his. He kind of had time, you know, for what we were doing on the ground. And then I think a very significant moment in my own relationship with him was when he called for a public march. It was in the state of emergency in 1981, when he called for a public march to bring to the attention of the world the fact that a colleague of ours had been detained. In those days, you could be detained for 90 days without any trial. So people were really literally disappearing for 90 days. But a colleague of ours, John Thorne, had been detained. And I think that really, because we were so convinced about John Thorne's integrity and credibility, Desmond Tutu called for a march, and he knew that we were breaking the laws of the state of emergency at that time. And there were 44 of us that responded to his call, and we were arrested and we were imprisoned. And then that brought, as it were, to the international attention, you know, particularly the case of John Thorne, but also the case of many other detainees who had been detained at that time. So kind of my own contact with him in many different contexts, local congregation, retreats over the weekend with young people, sharing a cell with him. But most probably most of the contact was when he was around the corner and in the basement of our church at the Central Methodist Church. We had what we called the People's Restaurant. And it was the only restaurant in Johannesburg where white and black people could eat together. And so he would often come and have lunch there. And that's where ongoing contact could happen. And then I think when I left Johannesburg after 81, I witnessed his life mainly from a distance. Mm-hmm. There were one or two moments again when our paths crossed, but I then moved out of Johannesburg, whereas he stayed in Johannesburg. And then when he became Archbishop, he obviously moved down to Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've gone around the block a little bit in response to your question, what I learned from him, but I just thought I would kind of give the context for the influence that he had upon my own life. It was really just watching his life and witnessing his life close up that somehow gave so much credibility and integrity and credibility to the words that he spoke in public.
Did you get a sense of the shaping of his character and what maybe practices or disciplines that helped?
Sure, yeah. It's really interesting reading his own, you know, there've been a number of books written about him. I think one of the best is Rabble Rouser for Peace, which is a biography, I think, by John Allen. And his own conversion happened, and this is so moving. He grew up in what we would call a township. You know, blacks and whites were very strictly segregated. So he grew up in a very poor township. His mother was a domestic worker. I don't know if that word would have meaning within your context. She would work in the homes of people that perhaps could have...
Like a maid?
A maid, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So a domestic worker. And when Desmond was, I think, 6 or 7 years of age, in the township where they lived, there was an Anglican priest, a white Anglican priest, by the name of Trevor Huddleston. And every morning, he would watch Trevor raise his hat in greeting to his mother. And it was that very simple act of profound courtesy that I think really touched young Desmond's heart, and that I think gave birth to a curiosity in his life in terms of the Christian faith. And when he, I think Desmond as a young boy got tuberculosis, I think it was, and then was in hospital for a long time, Father Trevor Huddleston would come and visit him, this young boy in hospital once a week. And so there was this tremendous witness of Trevor Huddleston upon his life. Trevor Huddleston was a monk in the Community of the Resurrection, which is an Anglican order. And so Desmond was drawn into the Anglican Church through the witness of this Anglican monk. And when Desmond himself entered the priesthood, the Anglican priesthood, So Desmond did get married to Leah. His formation was within this rather high Anglican context of the Community of the Resurrection. So you could almost say Desmond's early formation within the Christian faith was a very sacramental one. You know, often at Renovare, we speak of the different streams. He certainly would fall very deeply into the sacramental stream. So that was formative. And I think there was so much that was formative. But a moment that I think by Desmond Tutu's own admission, an event that really deepened his radical opposition to apartheid so that he really became actively involved in the struggle against apartheid. He didn't himself take up arms, so he maintained a non-violent stance in the struggle. Many people, as people would know, left the country, became part of the armed struggle against apartheid. But he had a very significant turning point when he met a young seven-year-old in one of the resettlement camps. Part of the apartheid structure was that very often people were removed to what were called homelands, so that the majority of South Africa could, quote unquote, be dominated, as it were, by whites. And these areas were often very poverty-stricken. He met, I don't know how old she was, 6, 7 years of age, and she said to him these words, "When I get hungry, I drink water." And I think, you know, I think that was a burning bush moment in Desmond Tutu's own formation. And it also became a bit of a turning point. He kind of stepped into the prophetic role very powerfully after that event in many different ways. And then his own formation, you know, Desmond, I think if I had to describe him, he was a real contemplative in action. You know, part of his own rule of life was each year spending 8 days in silence, and he would often go to a little retreat place called St. Benedict's here in Johannesburg. And he was, you know, he was unobtainable when he was on retreat. There's a story that goes around, and I know it's true, is that he was on retreat once at St. Benedict's, and it was just post-94, and he got a phone call from the president, Nelson Mandela, and he did not take the call and would not take the call. And it was like just, you know, it was just a, you know, this deep commitment to the life of prayer. And yet it was never a privatized spirituality at all. You know, it found expression, obviously, in a deep commitment to the human struggles that take place. And obviously that was informed by his theology. You know, his theology, you know, Genesis 1 and 2 came before Genesis 3, he would often say. And he used to have a saying which really touched me, you know, that every human being is a God carrier. And I know some folk, you know, might battle with that, but this real deep commitment to a theology that affirmed that we are really image bearers. And no matter how that image gets scarred, or how, no matter how depraved that image may become, we always retain some of that image within our life. And so he would say, and I, you know, I can just hear him saying this, you know, as we genuflect before the sacrament, so we should genuflect before every human being, for they carry the image of God.
I don't know that word, genuflect.
Genuflect is, you know, when you bow.
Okay.
When you bow before the sacrament, or bow before the cross, as one would in that very high church tradition that he was part of, he would speak of the importance of bowing, of genuflecting before human beings. So, you know, I think of C.S. Lewis, you know, the weight of glory in every human being. And certainly I think that theological conviction really shaped his life. And it gets depicted, you know, like in one of the titles of his books, Made for Goodness, you know, that we are made for goodness because, you know, we are image bearers. So when you talk of what was formational, I have little doubt that his own pain of growing up in South Africa as a black person formed him deeply. I think that he was on the receiving end, particularly during the apartheid era, he was on the receiving end of abuse, of insult, of threat. obviously from many, many white people, most probably the majority of white people. Many white people changed their view of him, strangely enough, in the post-apartheid era, particularly when they became aware that he was not aligned to a political party and that he was free enough, you know, to be critical. He was critical at times of Nelson Mandela. He never lost that prophetic edge. You couldn't box him in one party. One of his books, one of my favorites of his, is called God's Dream. You know, he just had this deep sense of God's dream of a new world. And he wanted to be, I guess, a kind of agent of that new world. So someone who was biblically and theologically formed, that formation seemed to override any kind of political boxes that people maybe wanted to put him into.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I could go on, and I just need to be so careful. I don't want to bore you or your listeners. So I'm
getting. No, this is so,
so
good.
I'm going to keep following what you're curious about and what you're interested in.
There's many things that fascinate me, but one is, as he gained power and influence to maintain that moral authority, I'm just thinking, what was it that enabled him to do that?
Yeah, I think a number of things, you know. First of all, I think in his own way of life, he was credible. I'm sure that he could have amassed a fortune, you know, in terms of speakers' fees around the world, you know. He set up a foundation which still exists today, the Desmond Tutu Foundation. And so there was a sense in which he maintained at the level of his own personal life, his own life as a follower of Christ. There was a sense in which almost behind the scenes of his public life and his public persona, you know, there was this human being who followed Christ, who worshiped God, who was a husband and a father. And, you know, you couldn't pick up dirt on him, as it were. There was just this moral, his own life was a kind of moral way of being. So I think that gave him a great deal of credibility. I think what gave him credibility too was, you know, he never watered down his own. He had the wonderful ability to be very respectful of other religious perspectives. Very. So he co-authors a book with the Dalai Lama, you know, on joy. So he does that and yet would never water down his own Trinitarian commitment. So for example, if he was asked to do prayers at an interfaith gathering, you could be pretty sure that it would be strongly Trinitarian. And he wasn't in that way trying to make a point. I think he was simply being faithful to his own faith and his own commitment to the Trinitarian God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a credibility to that. While he was remarkably open and generous and honoring of other perspectives, he could do that in tension, and he, I'm sure, lived in that tension with his own faith.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us the story of when you both were incarcerated?
Oh, yes. That's such a funny moment. We were there and he said, you know, there's a story in the book of Acts about prison doors opening. Let me go try this one, you know, or something to that effect. And went across and opened and the door opened. And then I think, you know, we were not too sure what to do next. So we kind of walked inside and closed the door. But it was just, I think that's the other thing about him. He had an incredible sense of humor, and he would often joke at his own expense, often. It was kind of a humility, you know, that he could laugh at himself and you know, hence his kind of co-partnership with the Dalai Lama in the Book of Joy, which is a beautiful book also of their friendship and their respect for each other. and their willingness to, well, publicly witness to their friendship, although they were both deeply faithful to their own faith, you know, their own faith traditions. And one moment when Desmond Tutu really took on the government in post-apartheid South Africa was when the Dalai Lama was refused access to South Africa by the ANC government. And that really, really, I think, angered Desmond Tutu very much. And he really engaged the government very strongly on that. But equally, you know, as he could laugh, so he could cry. And some of my most moving memories, you know, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was, for those listeners not aware of that, in the post-apartheid South Africa, we had a process called Truth and Reconciliation. And it had many flaws within it, and it has been critiqued. It also had many profound moments where people who committed atrocities during the apartheid era could publicly confess to those atrocities in the presence of the families of those that they had committed those atrocities against. He headed up that commission, and there were many times when he just wept. He would just weep as he listened to stories. So he would just break down and weep. And one of the things I think which angered maybe many people, particularly within the Black community who had suffered greatly under apartheid, was that Desmond Tutu would not let go of the need for forgiveness. You know, he saw forgiveness as a fundamental dimension of the Christian faith. And I think one of his books, I'm not an agent for his books, but one of his books is There Is No Future Without Forgiveness, you know. And so he was prepared, even within his own community, he was prepared to represent a very unpopular Christian foundational commitment that we have. Also, his love for enemies, you know, he really refused to demonize people who represented the apartheid government. He critiqued them on theological grounds. He spoke, but he would always be willing to enter into conversation in a respectful way that honored the image of God within them. So he kind of embodied that. And I think for me, it's how, you know, bringing joy and sadness together. He just had a big heart, and somehow within that heart could hold opposites together, you know, joy and pain, joy and sadness, joy and suffering. And he embodied that. He embodied that very, very powerfully.
This is so good. A quote or two of his that's been particularly meaningful to you?
I go back to that Bible study when he asked us all, why do you think God created us? And we gave all these different reasons. And then eventually, and most of the reasons we gave him were something around, you know, God kind of was got lonely. And I remember the one quote was, you know, God has never, ever been lonely. That in God, there is this relational abundance of Trinitarian love between the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And then he would say, you know, why do you think God made us if God wasn't lonely? Well, God made us because God wants us. And God wants to be in friendship with us, you know. So that, you know, that just comes back to me, you know. 1978, I don't know how many years ago that is now, but just I can still hear him saying that. I can still remember a beautiful, beautiful picture he gave of contemplative prayer. I can't quote him, but I can share the picture. You know, that when we are with God, it's like sitting next to a fire, and we just sit next to the fire. We don't do anything. And then over time, as we sit next to the fire begins to warm us. And then as we begin to get warm, we begin to take on, you know, some of the flame of the fire in our own being. And just that he was so against techniques in prayer, but that picture is like, you know, what it's about. You know, it's prayer sitting next to the fire and allowing God to warm you. And sometimes you have to sit there for a long time or I have to sit there for a long time because I can be pretty cold, and it takes a bit of time for God's Spirit to warm me up again with that deep love of that fire. So he spoke with pictures, and then the word beloved was a very, very, you know, I saw him in some of the most secular environments. One environment, let me just quote, with a secular journalist, and then him reaching out to the secular journalist who had no professed faith and saying to him, in his own way, I want you to know that God really loves you. You are precious to God. And then one of you, you know, God has faith in you. And now if someone else says it, I would feel a bit uncomfortable. But somehow Desmond Tutu saying it, you know, backed up by the credibility of his life, somehow those words feel much more powerful than if someone else said, or if I said it, you know. But somehow there's this power of a life, a credible life, so that when he says something which could sound cliched, it doesn't sound cliched at all. And then I remember when he would come and speak to us, on the camps with young people, he would say, you are all God's princes and princesses. Now behave like one. You know, it wasn't being legalistic. It was appealing to we made for goodness. Let that be expressed. Don't let yourself down. Don't let God down. And then his little phrase always, you know, God has faith in you. Don't worry too much if you haven't got faith in God. God has faith in you. So, you know, you can get a feeling from what I'm saying of the, you know, just of the rich themes of his own theology and his own understanding of Scripture. And obviously it kind of just deeply, deeply, deeply touched my own life, because I was in my 30s, I was 40s, obviously, you know, struggling to work out what it meant to follow Christ and what witness looked like. And, you know, his voice was very, very strong in my own imagination of what Christian faith and what following Christ is all about.
It's good. I can seeing a picture of him and his smile, and it just fits everything of what you're saying. Of such a, look like such a delightful sitting by the fire. Huh?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Trevor, thank you so much. This is helpful and fun, inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's just lovely to reflect on his life with you and with those listening.
And that was Trevor Hudson talking about Archbishop Desmond Tutu. We'll list Desmond's books that Trevor referenced in the show notes. I just looked it up, and this was my 8th podcast with Trevor. If you go on the Renovare website, type in Trevor's name, you can find a link to each one. But a couple of note. Episode 153 was on his book, Pauses for Lent. Episode 239 was on his book, Seeking God, Finding Another Kind of Life with St. Ignatius and Dallas Willard. And one of my all-time favorite episodes, 131, Listening to Our Groans. I'm Nathan Foster, and you've been listening to Life with God, a Renovare podcast. We're grateful for all of you who help make this work possible. You can support Renovare and this podcast with a tax-deductible gift at renovare.org/donate. Renovare is a Christian ecumenical renewal effort offering resources and experiences to help people become more like Jesus. You can find a collection of thoughtfully curated articles, podcasts, webinars, online classes, as well as information on events in our institute on our website at renovare.com. This podcast is produced by Brian Morricon, who also wrote the opening song titled Be Kind. And until next time, be well, friends. Be well.